So good afternoon, everyone. I'm a graduate student at the University of New Brunswick. And today I'll be talking about the path integral quantization of a cosmological model using matter as a time variable. So what do I mean here? So normally when we think about setting up a path integral for quantum gravity, really we're thinking about three basic ingredients, which are an action of some sort, or a weight, which tells us what is the contribution from each path or geometry that we are going to sum over in this path integral, the set of possible geometries that we are going to sum over, and a measure on that space of geometries that we are going to sum over. And ideally, some combination of these will give us something that is suitably convergent. And normally when we want to compute such an in path integral, we rely on various schemes, essentially discretization schemes. And sometimes one also hopes to regulate that integral by using a suitable discretization. So the discretization isn't essential per se, but it can be used to regulate this integral. However, and I'm just talking about this in from a more canonical perspective here. In some approaches, the discretization may actually be quite fundamental. So different approaches then use different actions. So the old Euclidean quantum gravity approach used some sort of Einstein-Hilbert action with some boundary terms. Spin foam models seem to use the BF type of action. Perhaps there is some other kind of discrete action one can postulate in an already discrete action, discrete system, for instance, in causal sets. But effectively, the idea is to try and calculate this amplitude, and not only calculate this amplitude, but also calculate expectation values of suitable observables. And so the amplitude is something that has been calculated in many different settings, with different ways of defining this path integral. So for instance, Hartle, Hawking calculated the amplitude over a certain kind by restricting the set of geometries that we are going to sum, that they chose to sum over. And effectively, what they were trying to do was find solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So they want to use the path integral to sort of project onto the solution space of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And that's something that one often wants to do in trying to do a sort of canonical path integral. But the other thing, the other interesting thing to calculate is expectation values of observables, and sort of try and relate these expectation values in some, so in a suitable limit to classical observables. And of course, one, it is not quite clear how to go from a discretized setting to a continuum setting, and one hope is that one can possibly do this in some sort of a, by looking for phase transitions, where really we transition, the phase transition tells us what the continuum limit of the theory would be. So what we are going to do here is actually much less ambitious than trying to set up a path integral for quantum gravity. What we want to do essentially is understand how we can compute this canonical path integral, and the ingredients of this canonical path integral are essentially the ADM action. So now we're thinking about a 3+1 split of the spacetime, and we have an ADM action. We can add on any other matter actions that we choose to, and any kind of suitable boundary terms that we would like to have a reasonable variation of this action, a reasonable variation principle. And what we are going to integrate over is essentially the extrinsic curvatures and the spatial metric, so the three metric. And of course, we have to include these formal integrals over the lapse and the shift to ensure that the geometries that we're integrating over satisfy the constraints of GR, or the we basically don't want to violate the diffeomorphisms. But in general, it's not quite clear how one does these integrals over the lapse and the shift. Because if I choose to do this in some discretized setting, then of course, how am I breaking the symmetry is a question that doesn't have a very clear answer. Computing these integrals is not quite straightforward. And the other problem is, how does one relate this to our classical notion of dynamics, which is dynamics with respect to some sort of time? And one way to do this is to think of an intrinsic time in the system and relate the notion, and then derive a notion of dynamics from that intrinsic time. And what do we want to calculate using this? We want to calculate, of course, the transition amplitude, which is just the amplitude which could mean a bunch of different things, and it could mean the amplitude to go from particular four geometries to other four geometries. It could mean the amplitude to go from a specific kind of three geometry on a boundary to a different three geometry on the boundary by summing over all four geometries. Or it could mean transition amplitude in terms of transitioning from a particular state with respect to some sort of internal time to a different state. So it's evolution then in this internal time. And how can we do this? Numerically, we can do this using path integral Monte Carlo techniques. But in order to do that, we need to either consider Euclidean geometries or we need to Wick rotate. And of course, if we could define a time variable and chose an intrinsic time, then our Wick rotation would actually be a very well-defined thing. And that's what we would like to do. So really, we want to fix a gauge. What we want to do is we want to fix a time gauge. Then this allows us to get rid of this integration over the lapse. It also gives us a notion of what it means to evolve with respect to this time. And we want to go a bit further, and we want to use a matter time, because matter is intuitively, when we think of clocks, we're really thinking about matter clocks. Perhaps, at least I'm thinking about matter clocks, and not sure. So how would we do this? We can start with a really simple sort of matter field. So let's think about general relativity with dust. And so the action is just the Einstein-Hilbert action and this dust Lagrangian here. And M is a Lagrange parameter which enforces the fact that the velocity of the dust is time-like, the four velocity is time-like. And M also plays the role of, on shell, M also plays the role of the energy density of the dust field. The ADM action for this theory is straightforward. It's just like so, where H now is the Hamiltonian constraint, which is just the Hamiltonian constraint for general relativity plus a dust field plus the Hamiltonian constraint for the dust. And the C is just the diffeomorphism constraint. And the nice feature here is once we vary this action with respect to M, or sorry, once we vary this action with respect to M and plug in the equation that we get for M, we find that the Hamiltonian density for the dust field is actually linear in the dust momentum, which means that the evolution of the dust field is going to be monotonic. So then we can use this monotonically evolving dust field as time. So that amounts to just imposing a simple gauge condition here. So this is our gauge fixing condition. And demanding that this be preserved in time fixes the lapse for us. And it fixes the lapse to 1. And of course, we can go back and solve our Hamiltonian constraint now. And remember, the Hamiltonian constraint is linear in the dust momentum. So the physical Hamiltonian is this very simple quantity here, which is just what used to be the Hamiltonian constraint for GR. And the gauge fix action now takes this form, where the lapse has been fixed. The shift is still free, so we still have three spatial diffeomorphisms here. And this very much looks like a gauge theory, a regular sort of gauge theory that we're used to, with the spatial diffeomorphisms being the gauge. Okay, so any questions so far? The other simplification that occurs actually is the diffeomorphism constraint for the dust field, which is in this gauge fixing is just zero. So really, this constraint here is just the diffeomorphism constraint for GR.
And M doesn't appear?
No, because we solved for M. We varied the action with for M. And then we got an equation, we plug that back in, and we solve for M. So C is just derivative of the extrinsic curvature.
You have to take some
the covariant derivative. There are no square roots involved because the Hamiltonian constraint was linear in the dust momentum. So once I solve that constraint, it's linear in the dust momentum, so there's no square roots involved. So that's the other feature that distinguishes it from other matter gauges, where normally one would expect a quadratic term in the momentum, and that would give us a square root Hamiltonian. Okay. Other questions?
I'm just going, because when you resolve the constraints, there's only two branches in that equation. No. Dmu phi squared.
So that's the thing. So normally you have dmu phi, but then once you plug in the equation for M, it simplifies that, and you end up with a Hamiltonian that's actually linear in the momentum. So you don't have a p phi squared, you have a p, you just have a p. So if you want to relate back what to the dust density, then it just turns out that the dust density is just the physical Hamiltonian divided by the determinant of the metric, of the spatial metric. But the fact that the reason we don't have these two branches is because it's linear in the dust moment, the Hamiltonian density is linear in the dust moment.
So you pick one of the two solutions?
There is only one solution.
So what is p-phi in terms of the field? It's not d0 phi.
P-phi in terms of the field. It's d0 phi on shell.
Yes.
Yes.
So here there's the same thing.
Stop.
If I may ask, so these Fieker constant surfaces, hypersurfaces that now define your foliation,
that's right.
Are they arbitrary or do they satisfy some constraints? Is the extrinsic curvature on them, for instance? Is this foliation that you get generic or are there some special constraints on the extrinsic curvature? Do these hypersurfaces have this specific shape, or can they just be anything?
No, they cannot just be anything because one has fixed the lapse. So effectively, you have these hypersurfaces, and really what you're looking at are three geometries that are embeddable in this fashion. It does not allow for all kinds of three geometries. So what I want is the four metric should always be, there should be a patch where the four metric can take the form minus dt squared plus whatever. And that is in some sense restricting. the extrinsic curvature. Does that make sense? So not all possible three geometries can be embedded in this, can be foliated in this fashion. Or not all possible four geometries can be foliated in this fashion.
Is phi the entire, well, it is the field in classical right?
That's right.
Okay. It's not an expectation value.
No, this is all classical. There is no nothing quantum here at all. Okay, so we're doing a classical gauge fixing, and then we're going to we're really deparametrizing our theory, and then we're going to quantize it. Okay. So what does this extra? So now we've had this extra degree of freedom in the geometry sector, effectively. And what does this degree of freedom do? So classically, we looked at perturbation theory, so around a Minkowski space. And we find that the scalar degree of freedom is actually non-propagating. So it doesn't mess up any of the linear calculations in any way. And we do recover the usual graviton modes at linear order. So that's nice, I guess. And we also looked at Bianchi 9 spacetimes, the dynamics of Bianchi 9 spacetimes. The hope was, can we actually recover? So Bianchi 9 spacetimes close to the singularity have a transition law for the scale factors. You have three scale factors, and there's a specific way in which they can change. And we find that we can actually recover that dynamics in this gauge as well. And as a bonus, we also can write down a similar sort of transition law for in some intermediary regime, which includes this matter degree of freedom. So this is the idea with Bianchi 9 spacetimes is close to the singularity, the dynamics is going to be vacuum dominated. But how does it get to be vacuum dominated? So we can actually see how that does degree of freedom is decoupling in this asymptotic limit. So classically, things are good. It doesn't really mess up many. This time gauge is a good gauge. Now we would like to construct the path integral for this deparametrized theory. So the path integral then just takes the form like this. We can always tack on any more matter fields as we like. It's basically just an addition of the matter Hamiltonians. The matter actions. And now we have this physical Hamiltonian. There's no more integration over the laps. So we're not changing our foliation anymore. And we still have this a shift function. We still have the three spatial diffeomorphisms in this theory. And of course, this. Even though this is simplified, it's still not easy to do. So we decided, let's first look at a toy model here and see what that tells us about. We want to look at a cosmological toy model and see if we can connect to some sort of classical cosmological observables. So the model here is just FRW plus dust plus some cosmological constant. That's the model we're going to look at. So really, we're restricting this integral, the summation over homogeneous and isotropic metrics. And the gauge fixed action takes this quite simple form, where A is related to the scale factor. It is not the scale factor, but it's related to the scale factor. And you can think about it as the determinant of the spatial metric is just A to the fourth.
So in principle, if you didn't do anything to the action, the original action with dust, you would have to sum over all field configurations, right?
That's right.
Also the flat integral. So where exactly did it go now that you're using this action?
So the dust has disappeared from the system, right? But for in exchange, what you've done is you've added this extra scalar degree of freedom in.
What is exactly in here?
So it's in the fact that the Hamiltonian is not a constraint anymore. it's a physical Hamiltonian.
Because yeah, this HP has the momentum of the.
It's just that it's not a constraint. This HP is just what used to be a Hamiltonian constraint. It's not a constraint anymore.
Okay. A constraint for what? For the field, I don't remember what that HP is.
So HP is just the GR Hamiltonian. It's just this. Well, this is the GR Hamiltonian.
Oh, okay.
This is pi AB, pi AB. But the fact, it's not a constraint. So we get this gauge fixed action. And so lambda is the cosmological constant, and k is just telling us what our spatial hypersurfaces are like. Are they flat or closed or open? And we see that for spatially flat FRW, so for the k equals zero case, this is the action for a harmonic oscillator. Or for some, not necessarily a harmonic oscillator, that would depend on the sign of lambda, but for an oscillator. So quantizing that system is effectively, well, it's trivial, it's been done a million times. And if we actually think about this as an oscillator on a half line, we find that, that's what we did in this paper, we find that it's quite a clean way of showing singularity avoidance for all possible values of the cosmological constant. So this is in this limited deparameterized model, where we're just looking at homogeneous and isotropic cosmology, spatially flat homogeneous. In the case where k is non-zero, this integral is not, the path integral is not analytically tractable. So what can we do there? So now we have a well-defined time parameter. We can go ahead and do a Wick rotation and convert what used to be e to the minus is to this e to the minus se, which can then be treated as a probability distribution, given that se is suitably well-behaved. And se is just the Euclidean action, so it's the Wick rotated action. And as you can see, for lambda positive, this action is going to be positive definite. So this is really a Gaussian integral with a little bit of a perturbation.
You mean lambda negative?
Oh, sorry, yes, lambda negative. Thank you. For lambda negative, this is going to be positive definite. It's nice and convergent. And so this integral is convergent for all values of Euclidean time. However, for lambda positive, one can show that it's convergent as long as t is less than pi over square root of lambda. So we can still do some Monte Carlo simulations as long as we limit the value of our t. Okay. And how do we actually do this? We have a probability distribution. What we would like to do is sample paths from our take samples from our probability distribution, and then calculate observables, averages of observables on those samples. And we use a standard Metropolis algorithm to do this sampling. And what we would like to calculate using these samples, in the lambda less than zero case, we can calculate the ground state wave function. That's the large time limit here. So we can calculate the ground state wave function. We can calculate various observables in that ground state. It's not, for lambda greater than zero, we can try and study fluctuations around classical paths. So really what we want to see is there some way to have classical paths emerge here. So we would look at expectation values of observables and compare them to classical solutions in the Wick rotated, in the Wick rotated classical solutions. And we can calculate what I'm going to call the no boundary wave functions. By no boundary wave functions, I really just mean that we're going to look at paths which start out at A equals zero. So the spatial volume here is zero. Okay, and how are we calculating the expectation values? The expectation value is just given as so. Once we Wick rotate this, this is e to the minus se. And we fix the, so we basically generate paths with some fixed endpoints for some value of t, calculate our observables on those paths, and average them. That's how we calculate expectation values. We calculate wave functions by, again, starting out paths at some value of a, and allowing the endpoints of the paths to be free. And then we essentially, so these are not wave functions, they're actually probabilities. And we bin them at a specific time step. So we bin the values of A at a specific time step over all paths. Okay. So with the lambda less than zero case, we have a unique ground state. This is in Planck time. And we see that the wave function is quite nice. It's a nice Gaussian, centered on zero, as we would expect. And we can calculate correlation functions in this ground state. We calculated the two-point correlation function. And we see that the blue line here is an exponential curve. And the black line, the black dots, is just the average. And we see that it is exponentially decaying, which is kind of nice. We expect locality, so this is good. But there's not much more interesting in the lambda less than zero case. For the lambda greater than zero case, what we can do is think about what are fluctuations around classical paths like. And the way we do this is we start out paths that are pinned on some classical solutions. So the endpoints are fixed on some classical solution, and the rest of the path can be arbitrary. And we find that after thermalization of our algorithm, once we start sampling, we find that the averages of A actually are quite close to what the classical solutions look like. So the red curves are the classical solutions, and the blue curves are just the average of A on all paths. And we also find that the fluctuations in this, if you calculate the volume and look at the volume fluctuations die out as the volume increases. So these paths are more or less monotonically increasing. Maybe this one not so much. But you can see as with time, these fluctuations are dying out as the volume's getting larger. So that's something nice. We do expect for large volumes that the volume fluctuation is actually quite small. So that's bearing out intuition. So that gives us some confidence in these algorithms. Okay, we can also calculate no boundary wave functions. So the plots I have here are for lambda for positive lambda, lambda equals one. And remember these wave functions are squares of wave functions are actually calculated by just binning at specific time steps. So we've binned at t equals one, t equals two, and t equals three, and there's a certain amount of stability in these wave functions. What's more interesting is that these distributions get fatter as we decrease lambda. So the tails of the distributions get fatter as we decrease lambda, which is effect so that you can see that here. This is for lambda equals 1. This is for lambda equals 0.01. So effectively, that's saying that larger universes are more probable at a given time. Larger universes are more probable for smaller values of the cosmological constant, which is a good thing. We live in a very large universe, a very small cosmos. All right, just to summarize, we fix a time gauge before we actually set up the path integral. Our notion of dynamics here is going from a particular kind of spatial tree geometry to a different kind of spatial tree geometry. So what's the probability of transitioning from a given spatial tree geometry to a different spatial tree geometry? We looked at the dynamics for the spatially flat case is just that of an oscillator. And for the negative cosmological constant case, we have a unique ground state. For the positive cosmological constant case, it's nice to know that the smaller lambda gets, the more probable larger universes become. And we are able to study fluctuations around classical paths in the sense that we can, our algorithm converges to the classical path effectively, or in an, sorry, I must say, the classical paths dominate the average when we pin the paths onto some classical endpoints. So any questions?
Thank you.
No, there's more. Okay. This model is basically, it's not, of course, a full model of quantum gravity. It's even the toy model, even the full model here is not really a full model of quantum gravity. What it is a way to sort of make some contact with more, with observations in some sense, a theoretical observation. And what we want to do is sort of learn something about a full theory of quantum gravity from this. So what would, of course, we want to think that there are caveats here. One is that not all four geometries are allowed, as you said. There's only specific geometries which can be foliated in a particular manner are allowed. At the end of the day, it is a quantum theory of the evolution of three geometries. And I think one other thing is that the dust is really not a physical fundamental field. So why are we using dust?
Just to clarify, the Monte Carlo simulation was for an integral over one variable.
Yes. Ideally, we want to go beyond that. I mean, because this was the toy model, and then at the end of the day, we want to do a Monte Carlo simulation of the full theory, where we have this physical Hamiltonian, we have a Diffeo constraint, all geometries satisfying that Diffeo constraint and admitting this foliation are allowed, and we just want to do a Monte Carlo over that. That's the general idea.
I have a question as an outsider. I'm always fascinated when we use quantum mechanics to the size of the universe. So for example, you have harmonic oscillator. The frequency related to the age of the universe.
The frequency is related to the cosmological constant. So it's...
No. There is a similar Planck's constant in this.
That's right.
So is there an effective mass of the oscillator that you're studying? And also force constant, just related to harmonic oscillators that I know. Like Einstein's oscillators in solids.
I actually don't know what those are, but...
No, you know that. No atoms in a solid.
Oh, okay, I see. Just so, yes, there is a... So there is a force constant. So there is an H bar sitting in there. The lambda is really related also to the Planck length here. So we're looking at lambda over Planck length squared as the frequency, or square root of... Lambda, square root of lambda over Planck length is just the frequency of that oscillator.
What is not transparent is the role of quantum mechanics. But an outsider is like, when you deal with massive objects like the universe, I'm sorry, no, it's expressing feelings.
So effectively, we're thinking about the scale factor as a configuration variable and quantizing that. And that looks, the action for that looks like that of an oscillator. I mean, that's...
And the scale factor, you would say, is quantum.
Is quantum, yes.
But maybe you have to go back to the action equation. Okay. Here, so even exponential minus this here. So, I guess that's your question. What should appear in front of this E should be, in fact, the volume.
There are volume factors, yes.
Which means that, in fact, H bar effective is H, you know, it's divided by the volume.
Yeah, so there is a...
So that actually is infinitely spread. So it's not, I mean...
So there's a...
You have to reabsorb that into your definition.
So we did do that. So there is, of course, a fiducial volume here because I integrated out the d cube x. So there is some fiducial volume sitting there. But the volume of spatial surface would be this fiducial volume times the scale factor determinant of the metric, or A squared in this case.
Yeah, so when you're talking about the quantum mechanics of A, it's really the quantum, it's not really quantum mechanics of A, it's quantum mechanics of A times some power of the volume.
Yes.
So
A times the cube root of the volume.
Usually, you know, for
I see. Okay.
Power goes to zero. So that, I think there's a question why, you know, that's why usually we think that big objects are not quantum mechanical. Because the effect of H bar is humongous. Or it's, you know, it's divided by humongous number.
Right. That's, yeah, that's the one. Okay. So what do we want to do to go beyond this model is the obvious next step would be to look at anisotropic cosmologies, not the, and see if actually there are any configurations that are isotropic at large times. And I'm currently working on that. So for the Bianchi 1 case, if I neglect any spatial curvature, it turns out that just demanding positivity of the dust energy density gives you an action that is positive definite. So it gives you a Euclidean action that is positive definite. So now I don't have to worry about restricting my Euclidean time to any range. However, there so far don't seem to be any unique ground states here. And also, just by looking at the simulations, there doesn't seem to be any sort of emergence of classical paths like there was in the isotropic case. I'm not quite sure if this is just because my algorithm is not able to converge to it. So there's a landscape of degenerate ground states. And it's not clear how the algorithm is actually converging on this ground state. Is it sort of secluded into some small set of ground states? Is it moving around too much? So really what I want to do is think of a better sampling algorithm here. And that's what I'm working on at the moment. And of course, once I add spatial curvature to this, and that would be the next step, this becomes, the sampling gets even more difficult. So one really wants an efficient way of traversing this unique ground space of ground states. To give you an analogy, if you think about, say, like a Mexican hat potential in quantum mechanics, you have this degenerate set of vacua, if you have an algorithm that converges there, it doesn't actually converge to one particular vacuum. It's kind of hopping around in the vacua. So there are two things that are required there. One is you need an observable that's sort of invariant under these vacua. In that case, it's really simple. It's just the polar coordinate r. But if you were not clever about it and you looked at, say, theta, you would always get a different result and it wouldn't look like anything is converging. And so a similar thing might be happening here. So one, we need a good observable. Two, we also need to be able to sample the whole space of vacua well. And at the moment, the algorithm is not doing that very well. So I'm working on that. The other thing I would like to do here is then to move on to Gaudi models, because Gaudi models are really simple 2D field theories. They're well studied classically. There are some quantizations of the Gaudi model in Ashtaka variables. So that would be something interesting to compare to. And of course, now we have that diffeomorphism constraint that we are dealing with. So we also have to think about how are we going to discretize the system appropriately and recover as the discretization scale goes to zero, recover this diffeomorphism invariance. As far as thinking about looking at more classical solutions and sort of looking at fluctuations around classical solutions, the next thing I would like to do is sort of sample these Lifshitz thimbles. So if you remember here, there is no emergence of classical paths. And unless one can think of a good observable, there's not going to be any way to compare to some sort of semi-classical dynamics. So what can we do here? We can really do Monte Carlo on these Lifshitz thimbles. So here we are actually putting in a classical path by hand and then sort of studying what the fluctuations around it are. And how does that work? That works quite straightforwardly, actually. You just complexify your coordinates. So these are now the configuration variables that one is complexifying. And the expectation value of the operator then just looks like so. And of course, if this phase, you're now sampling from the weight, sorry, is the exponential of the real part of the action. So what you're doing here is if the phase is well behaved, this will give you a nice convergent value. If the phase is going all over the place, then this is not a good reweighing. So one thing one can do is look at surfaces sample on surfaces where the phase is constant. These are exactly the Lifshitz thimbles, which are effectively these higher dimensional analogs of your curves of steepest descent, contours of steepest descent. And these Lifshitz thimbles are defined by this flow equation on the surface, where chi is this complexified coordinate. And if you start with some point on the complex plane, and the set of all points that flow to the critical point under this flow as tau goes to infinity is your Lifshitz thimble. So really what we want to do is now sample on that surface. So if you think about it, there's this critical point here, there's a surface around it, and we want to sample along that surface. However, we don't know what that surface looks like. We don't have much information about the curvature of the surface. Of course, if we solve this for sufficient number of points, we could then do this, but that's very expensive computationally. So what we do know is locally how this surface looks, because we can construct approximately at least the tangent space at the critical point. So even though we don't know the full curvature of the surface, we can sample anywhere on the surface by essentially selecting points close by and flowing them. This flow is invertible, so just flowing them away from the critical point. And for finite values of tau, we may not land on the Lifshitz thimble itself, but we will land close enough for sufficiently large values of tau. And what does that look like? Effectively, we're doing a change of coordinates, right? We're looking at points in a region close by, which gets mapped onto a region further away on the surface by this flow equation. And all we really need to do is find the Jacobian of that transformation, plug it in here, and we can calculate our expectation values in terms of these points, phi, which are actually close to the Lifshitz thimble. Which are close to the critical point on the Lifshitz. And that is, we can then do that. So there's this extra phase factor that appears, which is well behaved, much better behaved than this phase factor here. And we now weigh with respect not to just the real part of the action, but actually the real part of the action and the real part of that Jacobian determinant, which maps points here to the points further away. So that's the other thing I want to do next. And that was all, thank you.
So we have plenty of time for questions.
Wow, I spoke really fast.
So in your Bianchi one example, you have three configuration variables. Okay?
That's right.
Two configuration variables.
Three configuration variables.
Two configuration variables.
Yeah.
And so you could write, you have a physical Hamiltonian and no diffeomorphism constraints.
Yes.
And so you're saying if you take Hamiltonian, are Hamiltonian and look for ground states, is that what you've used, some one parameter or two parameters?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. It'll give you a degeneracy in some.
Degeneracy,
yeah.
in the cross case. Which. Physically, what is it physically? I mean, there's a, it's an anisotropy parameter. A, it's a, you said you have three ABCs, it's a universe which has three different lengths and three different direction. And so what, if you, it's a vacuum, it's a kind of a choice of direction which leads to the degeneracy.
So I'm not 100% sure about physically what it would mean, but it is sort of telling you that if, so I have this Hamiltonian, and it has a bunch of degenerate vacua in these three configuration variables, and somehow one of them is,
sometimes there's a global symmetry which kind of connects.
So we've already taken, there is no other symmetry here, that's the problem, right? At least I
which makes you jump for 1 week or 2 months.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what that is and why this, how I would explain this degeneracy in the. Because, yeah, for the Mexican hat potential, I'm thinking about a translation symmetry. Right. But I don't know what the appropriate symmetry here is. Honestly, I haven't given it much thought, also.
So, it looks as though this, at the very beginning, the matter time which you use is enforcing the. Something like Gaussian slicing beforehand, right? In the lattice as well.
Yeah.
And somehow you fix the shift.
Oh, we haven't fixed the shift. These are homogeneous models, so there is no diffuse. The diffuse constraint is trivial.
But I'm wondering, is there a more principled way to get at this, where you start with wanting to impose that gauge, and then you introduce the requisite goals, etc., stuff, and then you can somehow see that there's something effective that happens, or it's equivalent to adding in, I mean, call it dust, but it really looks like you have some kind of sigma model where the kinetic term just has this kind of decouples, just has a really large coupling in front of it, and all you're really imposing is the condition that, you know, the sigma model. The gradients, the fields, form time that so I'm wondering if you thought about that at all?
So no, we haven't thought about it, but there are some papers by Teitelbaum back in the 80s, I believe, where he does a similar construction, where not this construction, but the similar construction to what you're talking about, where he does want to impose the condition that n dot is zero. And he does a similar construction, figures out what are the additional terms that he needs to add to the action. So effectively, he imposes this delta function and tries to figures out how do you represent that delta function. But that, I don't know if it went anywhere after that. So, but no, we haven't thought about it in that context.
Just because even as a matter of principle, it's very peculiar that you have this frozen, I mean, that the frozen dynamics scale is what's giving you
yes.
The new parameterization, but fundamentally, why is there this, this decoupling? It's, I mean, it's really hard to understand, in some sense, because you proposed sort of equations of motion on shell beforehand, and then one
right.
But in some
but the dust field, yes.
Yeah, that's what you're saying, that you kind of get this decoupling of a quantum theory, this scalar field. Right? In some sense, the only action is this one that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, some of it should be, these two things should somehow be unique. I don't know. So let's see.
Can you say your question again?
So I'm saying that the dust is basically kind of signal model where you try to get anywhere, you added some really large, or you can get a very large shuttle. So I'm saying that you're frozen in the fact of the dynamics of the scalar, and then you're doing computation of the gravitational field. So there's some sense in which the scalar is parametric behavior. As then the gravitation. Now, generally that's very peculiar to my data, so I can say that on another level. Or you have to say that this scalar arises effective dynamics of ghosts that you use to gauge ships in its radial waves and you have n equals 1 gauge which one equals. And then you introduce the requisite ghosts, etc. for that. Somehow you're allowed. So basically, it's hard to argue why you're allowed to do this in the first place. Starting from just thinking of the quantization gives me this.
Well, I do believe it was a standard gauge pixel.
Yeah, it was a standard gauge pixel.
And what has been an issue with choosing a scale root.
Oh, no, there's a scale root.
Yeah, that there is no square root.
So the gravity coupled to some matter that has a particular equation of state, maybe that of dust.
Yeah.
Is that the Laplacian theory?
And then you gauge fix. I think that's all technically okay.
Yeah, no, you're saying that classically. When you're saying that quantum mechanics is, it's hard to argue that there's a field in fixed in some configuration in its ground state, even you know, you have the Planck scale. Why is the scalar greater than this?
It's an issue of gauge fixing, that your dust field in some sense goes completely out of the dynamics.
Right. So the dust is like some sort of fiducial field which does nothing, essentially, except give you this, I don't know, time parameter.
Yeah. But of course, there's a possibility what happens if you do it in other gauge fixing. There's not a big guarantee that gives you the same modulo, of course, that you can check for the list.
That's true. And yeah, one of the things I want to consider here is other matter gauge fixing and see what sort of dynamics I actually recover. So one thing to do would be to just use a massive scalar field.
Massive
scalar field,
you
get the square root
thing.
Yes.
Will be
the
important questions, and then.
Yeah, well, what it says is that in principle, if you're really interested, then the certain radial regressions to the matter action. Then there will be, in principle, radiative corrections to the matter action, which means that the equation you proposed at the very beginning, before you do the quantization, is subject to corrections, as in the form of the physical Hamiltonian itself will start to change, because the equation of motion that you had to solve to integrate out the matter field in the first place will now be different, right? When you have some radiative correction. So in some sense, you have to impose that there's some boundary normalization that's just frozen in order to actually do the quantization consistently. And this is a very peculiar thing to demand of a matter field. I mean, I agree this is not just an issue with this particular deparametrization, but deparametrizations involving matter fields in general, which is...
But that is something that happens with any kind of gauge fix theory in any gauge fixing. As long as you are gauge fixing.
Yes, no, I mean, there's when you're doing gauge fixing, say in gauge theory, you do have techniques to tell you how gauge fixing is compatible with internalization essentially. But this is a longer story.
Technology connects matter context. Suppose you take a ring of metal. At normal conditions, this behaves like metal, classical and so on. And once you go superconducting, you have this emergent degree of it, which is the quantum flux. So if you focus on that flux field, it behaves as a quantum mechanical object. You can define the moment of inertia, which makes genuinely quantum. So when you change this degree of freedom, macroscopic, Avogadro number of electrons change their state. But this fellow somehow speaks up. So I wonder if something is like that is going on when in quantum gravity problem, Penrose and Hartle wrote down the wave function of the universe. There is something which is spilling out a degree of freedom. It's a special condition. You see, the when you take a superconductor, everything is heavy, several grams, electrons, so, and somehow under some special condition, the degree of freedom spill out, which behaves quantum as a light degree of freedom. So I'm wondering whether such thing is happening in your heart or in your world. Sorry, I'm just
I wouldn't think so, because I mean the. What we are really doing is sort of treating the dust field as a classical variable here. And so really the only comment I can make to that is effectively when you deparameterize, you've sort of frozen out the dynamics of this dust field.
Because in the
quantum, there is no quantum dynamics.
The quantum dynamics, you can derive or you can extract an effective quantum behavior using some approximation. So it's very clear what's going on.
In some sense, aren't we trying to go in the opposite direction here? Where I don't know.
Oh. Yeah.
You compare your results with what you get when you gauge things, where when you take the time direction as the expectation value of vacuum of the field?
No, because we haven't done a quantization of the full dust and GR.
Even in this simple model,
no, we haven't done that comparison.
After the
quantization. No, we've not done the gauge fixing after the quantization. So that would be sort of, you know, some kind of relational variable in after gauge fixing, but no, that's not
so. So if I ask a question, have you compared your work to what people did with quantum cosmology, or do you find similar features? At some point you mentioned singularity.
So there is the singularity avoidance case, which is there is loop quantum cosmology in a scalar field. But we are really talking about, all we have here is dust and a spatially flat FRW. A sort of comparison would be to just add a scalar field and then think about how these results change. So the action changes a little bit when you add the scalar field. And it's not as straightforward as just an oscillator anymore. But that I do want to compare to results in LQC at some point, and that is why I'm interested in adding a scalar field and sort of looking at different gauges and seeing what I can say and what comparisons I can possibly draw. But that is a question of finding the right observables also.
When you say scalar field, are you thinking on treating it classically and fixing the gauge, or treating
yes.
all its dynamics?
Okay. Thinking of
so
treating it classically and fixing a gauge.
Before the quantization.
That's right.
So are there any further questions? So if that's not the case, that thing was right.